This is a story about people. This is a story of how an Army veteran put people first in business, grew to the top of his industry, and is now giving back in his community, back to the veterans. We're joined today by AP in our Phoenix, Arizona studios.
Thank you for having me, David. I appreciate it.
Well, I never know where to start. That's one of my problems on the show. But let's somewhat start at the beginning. When what led you up to join the Army?
I was an outstanding basketball player in high school. Went to college. For basketball.
Okay.
My father passed away and didn't really have a support system and said, well, I could go back to school at a later date. Wanted to do something, went home. Didn't want to get entangled into a lot of trouble in the neighborhood, and I ended up going to join the military. Had some buddies say, hey, I talked to them, and some guys I went to high school with, and said that we all went in together.
And this is obviously pre-9/11, so different military back then, which we're going to get into. I have a few questions about that.
This is 1989. When military wasn't a popular thing.
That's the point I was getting at. Back then it was not popular. Yeah, okay.
Right.
So you joined the Army, did that, and one of the things we talked about over our many breakfasts is the transition also going in wasn't popular, but also the transition out, it wasn't all the patriotic, the red, white, and blue, the flags and all that getting out. It was kind of like, oh, you served. Great.
Exactly. I actually got out of military. I applied to be a firefighter and a police officer and a state trooper. And I went into the unemployment office, filled out all the paperwork. And then the gentleman said, he said, come back again next week if you don't get that, and we can just find something else for you. Back then, they didn't have all the social media networks, and there wasn't all this patriotism to try to find veterans jobs. It was on the employment office and going to read the board.
And the transition out, I mean, what, a week, 2 weeks, you just signed the paperwork,
checked the box? It was the same day, actually, like the same day process.
Oh, wow.
When I got out, you would actually just go in, turn in all your stuff, sign your paperwork, say thank you, good luck.
And that was kind of, was that the kind of, not the norm, but a somewhat easy transition, try to get out and then try to get maybe a firefighter type job, police type job?
Well, I think one of the best things for me when I exited the military is I exited in Fort Knox, Kentucky, and I was a native of Louisville. So it kind of helped.
Okay.
Exiting somewhere else, I would have to go all the way back home, but I was actually going home on the weekends and spending time with my family and still had a lot of relationships, and I was cultivating relationships before I got out of the military.
So you've been networking from day one.
Yeah, well, you know, networking is your net worth.
Networking is your net worth. I wonder why more people don't understand that. And on a prior episode, we just had that conversation about networking, and it's the relationships behind you.
Yes, true statement.
So I'm so excited to get into the nuts and the bolts of this. You somehow, and I find this interesting because I've candidly never talked to anybody in this industry, you somehow got into the, entertainment industry, music industry, what's the term?
Sports and entertainment at the present time.
Okay.
Then I went full-fledged into entertainment, but initially it was sports and entertainment.
And that was new to you? I mean, you didn't study that, you didn't have a background in that. How did you get into it?
I just knew everybody, and I was just listening to conversations among guys that I played ball with and grew up with, and a lot of these guys were just asking for advice, and I would just be able to kind of lend my ear to the conversation, and that one thing led to another, and it's like, hey, AP, what do you think about this? AP, what do you think about that? And then I started getting other relationships because I used to play basketball at a place downtown in my hometown in Louisville called the Downtown Athletic Club, and I was around sports agents and attorneys, and I was listening to what they would say about athletes and entertainers, and I was like, maybe I could share that with my guys.
Interesting. You know what? I have this thing I call, you know, the chapters of your life, and that was kind of like a certain chapter. And when I've seen good things happen in my life, it's a similar type situation where you kind of just fall into it.
Right.
Like the business I'm in now, I literally just fell into it back in 2012 and 13. But then you really have to start learning the industry, right? I mean, you have to start mastering your craft. And so in 30 seconds, paint this industry, the sports management industry.
Yes, sports entertainment management.
So in 1 minute, what are you doing? Are you representing athletes? Are you negotiating contracts? What are you doing?
All the above. The main thing is making sure that you help the athlete to secure a great contract, making sure that he's set up for success and not for failure, and making sure that you surround him with the right people so he doesn't self-destruct. Because you're taking a young kid or a young entertainer, and you're providing him with things that he always dreamed about, or he saw on TV, or saw other people with. Now they're accessible to him because he can afford them.
Interesting. So are your relationships then with the teams?
Both. I actually had a mentor who had the relationships with the teams, and I had a relationship with the people. So we was a match made in heaven.
Oh, interesting. What aspect of the business was the hardest to learn in the first couple of years? The way you draft a contract?
I think personalities is the number one thing with anything on both sides, because you have so many people giving people advice. And when you're an athlete and you grew up in inner city like I did, a lot of people felt like they were a part of your success, indirectly or directly. So, you know, there was guys that lent you money. There was guys that helped you through certain things, through certain personal issues. I mean, there was guys that did a little bit of everything, because when you're from the neighborhood, the corporate world doesn't exist. Only thing exists is your surroundings, where you live at. And at that time, what's going on in your life and what's going on in that community that you stay in. So the rest of the world is kind of like obsolete at that time when you're a young guy and you grow up in inner city with a single parent home, or you don't have a father in your life or any of those things. The streets are your roadmap.
How good then? Well, that's the second part of the question. How much of the people then did you have to deal with? I mean, it was a business transaction, but you said relationships and was there a lot of personalities? You had to guide them. You had to get them to trust you, to sign with you.
Yes, I think you had to gain respect. Hmm. At the end of the day, it's the same values you learn in the military. You may not like what somebody tells you, but you have to respect the command and respect what they tell you. So I think I earned guys' respect because I grew up in the community. I wasn't a false prophet. I come from where they come from, and I can understand their gripe, their concerns, because I lived it.
Before you signed them, were there a lot of personal conversations about that? Was it a people-to-people type sale?
Excuse me. Yeah, it was. I think one of the main thing is, they wanted to make sure that you're being transparent and that there wasn't any hidden agendas, and you weren't taking them on a ride that they weren't going to recover from.
Interesting. And they don't know what they don't know. And they're looking to you for guidance and that.
Yeah, and I was learning at the same time. But one thing I learned is put people around you to know what you don't know. Mm-hmm. So I actually could share that information, and I would say, give me 24 hours, I'll get back with you. Mm. And I would bounce it off all the people that I had built relationships with that knew the business, from attorneys to athletes to, you know, guys I knew were very successful in the sports world. And I would say, hey, what do you think about this? What do you think about that? And then I would kind of share that information.
So walk me down this path. You're in the industry, you're going. What was the next milestone for you in the sports world?
I think I was with a company called Management One out of Cincinnati. My mentor was a guy named James Gould. He pretty much was one of the leading sports agents in the country. We actually met in Arizona. Short story is, I actually was out here with a friend who was trying out for the NBA, and he dropped his wallet. I picked it up, gave it to him.
The guy James dropped
his wallet in the airport, and he was telling me that he normally doesn't fly commercial, but he was flying commercial today. He normally flies private, and he needed his identification. He appreciated it. He had money in his wallet. I didn't touch anything. I just gave it to him. He said, what do you do? And I told him, I said, hey, you know, I live in Louisville, Kentucky. He said, well, I'm from Cincinnati. He said, why don't you come and visit me when you get back? And I drove up. I'll never forget, I had a 79 Cadillac that would barely make it around the corner. And I drove up to spend a day with him, and we hit it off the first time.
And that's how he brought you in and mentored you in this industry.
Yes, he did.
It's stories like that. I mean, you can't make that up. You hear that kind of stuff a lot. I mean, you met a guy, did this, did that, introduced me, and then those are the opportunities in life.
Yeah, well, you know, one thing is, I've learned in any businesses, if you're trying to monetize something, you have to be able to turn contacts into contracts.
Turn contacts into contracts. And he mentored you in this industry in the early years.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I would drive up. I'll never forget. I would drive up Tuesday and Thursday, and I would stay with my mom until my mom passed. Then I was somewhat homeless at the time. And I was, you know, bounce around home to home, friend to friend. And I just kept going. He's like, make sure you come every Tuesday and Thursday. And then even when my car broke down, I caught Greyhound and jumped on the Greyhound bus and then walked right over to the office, because Greyhound from Louisville to Cincinnati would let me off right downtown. And I would walk right to his office from Greyhound.
Were the first 4 or 5 years in the industry pretty grueling for you? Eye-opening, learning a lot?
Yeah, I think the main thing for me was understand how it all worked. I got to finally figure out how the sausage was made. Huh. And I was like, you know, sitting from afar, being an athlete, I never understood why, you know, the contracts, contractual agreements, relationships, had all played in to the big picture. And by me spending time with him and him being transparent and actually showing me everything, he didn't show me what I wanted to know. He showed me what I needed to know.
What's the one of the fastest things that'll kill a contract, kill a deal?
Mistrust. Will kill either from, like, if you're doing a negotiation with a pro team and they promise you this and they promise you that and it falls apart, then you got to share that back with the athlete. Mm. And then the athlete's like, hey, I don't want to play for him. I don't want to play for them because the trust is broken.
Mm. And that goes, that transfers over to everything in life.
It's a true statement.
You got to have that trust, everything. We've had that conversation on some other shows here. Wow, that's good. So you're growing up in this industry, per se, if that's the right term, cutting your teeth, you're learning. You're staying on path. What was kind of the next milestone then?
I think the next milestone was I had helped him with the sports side of the business. I actually was a vice president, became vice president of management one, helped him sign numerous number one picks, number one draft picks. And I was like, hey, I want to do something else, because all the guys that I were signing, they wanted to be in the entertainment business. Every athlete wants to be an entertainer, and every entertainer wants to be an athlete.
Interesting.
Believe it or not. So I was like, hey, what do you think? And one of the things I learned from him was, I was saying, well, if I actually start representing entertainers, I actually can contractually, we can open up a new business model. And he was like, well, I don't know if that works for what we're trying to do. But he says, I have an opportunity for you. He said, I'm an investor with a group in L.A., which is the premier management company in the world at the time, or top in L.A. and one of the top in the country, pretty much had controlled 90% of Hollywood. I went out, started off, just kind of didn't know what I was going to do there. Stayed with a friend in the projects in L.A., stayed in the jungle where you saw Training Day done at. I stayed in the jungle. I would go over every day to L.A., started off, and then eventually the guys gave me a chance, and I ended up becoming the vice president of that company.
I see a recurring theme in your life where you had these chances, but you had to have had the grit to stick it out and push through it.
Yeah, I'm a firm believer. Chances make champions.
Chance, if they can rise to the occasion.
If you can rise to the occasion.
But a lot of people can't.
Yeah, well, you can't give up. I mean, at the end of the day, I mean, there's 50, 60 guys trying to be a professional athlete. There's 50, 60 guys trying to represent the same athlete. What separates you from everybody else? And that's the determining factor. I have an old saying that he taught me, 1 + 1 = 3 if you become the common denominator.
Interesting. So what made you successful in your early days, would you say?
I think being able to go to L.A., country boy, I tell you a story that makes everybody laugh. When I first got to L.A., I'm riding around every day, and I've become the vice president of this company, which is the largest company, but I didn't know I'm from Louisville, Kentucky.
Yeah.
And so I'm telling the guy, I'm trying to get into the club. I'm calling Jamie Foxx on his cell phone, calling everybody, saying, hey, what do I need to do to get in? And Jamie's like, just come to the door and just tell him. And so I'm sitting at the door. I'm trying to bribe the guy with $100, $50. He says, wait in line. So then I actually talked to my assistant. He said, did you show him your business card? I said, no. So I walk up to the guy. He said, why didn't you say so? Go in and give him a table. He said, have a great night.
Interesting.
So I didn't know how the politics worked on that side. So it was a moment that I always look back on and laugh.
Kind of the who you know type story.
Yeah, I mean, it's just the Hollywood, because I never got a feel for how it really worked. I don't care who you are or whatever. You know, it's all about what your position is and who you are and who you represent.
Did you like that scene out there?
I liked it to a certain extent. I love the people. Love to get to understand people and see people from different walks of life, from rock guys to hanging with Fieldy from Korn, to hanging with E-40, to hanging with MJG and 8-Ball, and hanging with Fred Durst. You got to see all walks of life. It was very unique. And Kevin from the Backstreet Boys, me and him got really close. He was from Kentucky. And I got to hang out with him and Brian and seeing how it works on all sides and all genres of music.
How did you deal with all genres of music? I don't want to assume anything, but I could assume all genres of people, personalities. How did you deal with the gamut?
I think one of the things for me to deal with the gamut was understanding what the scope of what I was supposed to be doing. A lot of times you do what you want to do, but in this business and the business I used to be in, you had to put the client first. It's not what you thought. It's sometimes it's not what they thought. It's what the consumer thought, because you're in a consumer-based business. So like, for instance, you may want to pick a record that you may think's the best record in the world, but if the consumer doesn't think so, it's a dud.
Because at the end of the day, you have to sell the record, right?
Yeah, exactly.
And the consumers have to enjoy it, buy it.
Yeah, well,
it.
70% of your artists, the record that they picked is a no-go. It's usually the least record that they liked is the most successful one.
Interesting.
Just like Enrique Iglesias was signed to us. Enrique, initially, he thought Hero was okay. But we both know Hero became one of the biggest records in the world.
Interesting.
Mary J. Blige, she didn't like some of the records that we picked, but we transformed her, and she ended up doing pop records. She never wanted to cross over. She wanted to kind of stay to her demographic.
Interesting. I did not know that. So, do they feel guilty? Do they feel kind of bad about that? That maybe they're not pursuing what they want inside, but they have to do something to make it sell, you think?
I think that they didn't want to sell out. I think that they have a consumer, a base, and they feel like wanting to stick to what got them there. I think kind of exploring new opportunities, and I think sometimes can be a little iffy. Mm-hmm. Like, hey, what if this doesn't work? Have I alienated my audience? Have I alienated my fan base? Would they leave me?
Yeah. This just came to mind. Back to this real quick. You're having to sell these people to go with you, right?
Right.
It's a competitive industry. There's 30 of you lined up to say, hey, artists, sign with me. And I'm in sales. Is it a more of a personal approach to a sale? I mean, because I could only assume, and maybe I'm not, that all 30 might have similar type benefits from a pure monetary standpoint, maybe.
Right.
So what are you selling more of the personal aspect? Are you getting people to like you and that's the personal sale out of it?
I sold honesty. Huh. Honesty is what I sold. What you see is what you get. There's no curveballs. I mean, what you see is what you get. I'm going to be as transparent with you as possible. If you don't like it, let me help you understand it. But my ultimate goal is to be in your best interest, not mine.
And they felt that, obviously.
Yes. I mean, it's building camaraderie. Same thing. That's why I say the military was the greatest thing ever happened to me, because camaraderie became a focus for me, because I understood, like, when you march, everybody's on the same cadence. Everybody's on the same step. To be able to get a whole platoon to be in sequence is enormous. To see every guy, left foot, right foot, you know what I'm saying? Parade, rest. I mean, all the commands,
right,
to be able to do them simultaneously at the same time. Those things actually helped me transform into the civilian world.
We're going to get back to that when we talk about veterans at the end of this episode and what you're doing now. Tell me about a time, it's had to have happened. Everybody has it. You work so hard. You thought you had it. Something killed the deal. I mean, you just felt crushed.
I think for me, Floyd Mayweather. Floyd was a very close friend of mine. Floyd came to me when he actually HBO and Showtime. He and I met with Ross Greenberg and Showtime and those guys. At the time, Ross Greenberg was the president of HBO.
Wow.
Floyd and I met with him in LA in front of the hotel.
Wow.
And we and Floyd were sitting out there talking. And Floyd was like, hey, what do you think? And at the time, I didn't really want to get into the boxing business because there was a monopoly on it. You know, at that time, Don King, Bob Arum, it was a whole different aspect. I was just trying to make sure that I lent some advice to a buddy. I wish I'd have got in that business at the time. But actually just being able to, and you know, my company was like, why don't you bring Floyd in? And I was like, what do you think? They're like, you should bring him in. At the time, we had acquired Pony. And I got Floyd some new Pony stuff. And he was like, because, you know, he remember Ali used to wear a Pony and some of the boxers from the past used to wear a Pony. And Floyd was like, hey, why don't you... He said, can you give me some more of that Pony stuff? So he started coming up to the office, hanging out. And then my Jeff Quantness at the time, who actually helped Ice Cube start the basketball league. And he managed pretty much everybody in Hollywood at that time, from Korn to Ice Cube to everybody.
Wow.
And he was like, hey, why don't you get Floyd to sign with us? And I should have took advantage of the opportunity, but I didn't.
Mm-hmm.
I just wanted to leave it as a friendship.
Do you ever regret that?
Yeah, I do. I think that if I knew what I knew now, I probably would have tried to get involved with Floyd a little. I would have took Floyd's our relationship a little more serious and made it more business, but at the same time, we're still good friends.
Could you have, if you wanted to, could you have used that friendship to put the business in, or would it have been awkward?
I think Floyd would have been receptive to it, but I also think it would have just kind of caught him off guard.
That's
a real touchy subject.
Friends,
you
business,
hanging with a guy,
because
I didn't want him to think in the back of his brain, the only reason I was befriending him is because I had a hidden agenda.
I'm sure a lot of them think that, the entertainers. Yeah. Everybody wants something.
And I tell you a funny story. One of my buddies is probably the top entertainment attorney in the country. His name is James McMillan. And I'll never forget, I was at the firm one day and I was like, we need to do some remixes. So I said I wanted to do a remix to Limp Bizkit's record, Nookie. And then I took a record from Korn and remixed. So I called James up, and he's representing MJG and 8-Ball, which is one of the biggest groups at that time in the South. And I said, hey, James, what about doing a collaboration with Fred Durst? He said, well, how much would it cost us? I said, no, I'm going to pay you. He said, let me get this right. You're going to do a rock record with a rap group from the South, and you're going to pay us?
A rock record with a rap group from the South, and you're going to pay us.
And you're going to pay us. And I think that was like me, I kind of figured out that this is being able to kind of change the game. That was the first thing that I got to see the world from a different perspective in the music business and being able to reach back to my community.
Interesting. So let's get into that then, because you, I don't want to say second half of your life, but lately, maybe in the past 10 years, you've shifted your focus a little bit to give back to the community and what you're doing now.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I just actually, what I call is my own version of gumbo, being able to take all the relations I've met politically, all the relations I've met in sports and entertainment and in the private equity world, and bring them all together to serve the community.
I was going to get into that later, but let's get into that now. You've always had this, and I remember you telling me a story about breakfast. We can go into it if you want, but you said you, at one point in time in your vast many endeavors, you had this, and I'm going to mess this up, so help me, this project where you would get brands and help them bring their message into different parts of the community where maybe they haven't been before.
Yeah, I represented Harley Davidson, Crown Royal, Miller Coors, on and on and on, NASCAR, different people that I've represented. And I always said, how can I bridge the gap?
Interesting.
How can I bridge the gap? How can I bring everybody together? What would it be the determining circumstances to actually create some type of merger? And I actually was convincing companies to do what's happening now. I was actually trying to do these complex deals in 20 years ago. I was trying to do deals that you see in the vitamin water deals now, but
why you saw ahead? You saw this was an untapped,
untapped.
You know, industry or market or way of marketing per se.
But at that time, artists just wanted the money up front. Entertainers wanted the money up front. They just wanted an endorsement fee or public appearance fee, and would rather take the $1 million. But nobody believed in the back end. Nobody wanted to be an equity partner. They just wanted to get the money up front in case it didn't work.
Hey, I always want the equity.
Yeah.
You can keep the cash. Give me the equity.
Yeah, but equity wasn't, in those days, equity wasn't
wow.
a conversation that you had, because then it felt like you was taking advantage of them. You was getting what you could get, but they couldn't get theirs till later.
We're going to come back to that. My mind's going a million miles an hour. Did you have a desire to be successful when you got out of the Army? Maybe you didn't know what you were going to do, but did you have that internal something in you?
Yeah, I think when you go from getting out of the military, the not being able to get employed, growing up in the inner city with a single house mom, and you know, being able to take guidance from the communities that you grew up in and listening to the streets and trying to be in survival mode. Yeah.
Wow. Was that a new opening in your life when you started working with these brands, everything you just mentioned, Crown Royal, Harley Davidson, helping them with new representation per se, or new messaging and new communities? Did that also kind of, was that a beginning to what you were doing today?
Yeah.
In the community and that community involvement?
Well, because at the end of the day, believe it or not, urban drives suburban. Suburban doesn't drive urban.
Urban drives suburban.
The kids in the suburbs, the kids in the Hamptons, the more fortunate kids to go to the private schools, they think it's cool to have what they're not used to. So that's why you see the Rockawares then and the Sean Johns, and you saw the young kids in the white family wearing all hip-hop gear. It even got to the point when I was in Texas doing work where they even created a term called herbin, which was Hispanic and urban. I actually helped create that term.
Wow.
It was called urban, being able to merge the Hispanic community with the urban community. And they even created a music genre called urban music.
Wow. You've always seemed to see the new trends coming. And not only have you seen the new trends coming, you've always seemed to find a way to connect the dots.
Well, yeah, I've been a good listener. Mm-hmm. I think the key to success for me is being a good listener and being able to find middle ground. It's almost like if you was a politician, to be in the middle, to be able to have relationships on both sides of the aisle. And that's how I've attacked the business world, to have relationships on both sides, in the suburban world and the urban world. Like, I had a guy call me the other day. He's a very good friend of mine. I just say his name is Jonathan Flicker. Jonathan Flicker was actually the founder of Proactive. He's ran some of the biggest companies in the world. You know, he was actually the head of Guthrie Renker. He created the infomercial world. He called me the other day and was just, he used to call me and say for advice. And he said something the other day. He said, I'm calling you because I just invested in a major, one of the largest urban companies in the world. And I want you to be on my board. And I said, really? He said, yeah. He said, because you're going to tell me what nobody else is going to tell me. You're going to tell me the truth.
Wow.
And he said, I can share that with my boards and my stakeholders, that you're going to give us an honest opinion if we want to hear it or not.
Wow. What are the, growing up, what are some, not growing up, in your, when you started and you know nothing in the industry per se,
right,
nothing about the industry, to when you could go to bed at night knowing, I know this industry, what were some of the key, was it mentorship? Was it you studying? How do you learn a brand new industry?
Well, I think the main thing is I lived it. When I used to listen to the lyrics of a lot of the songs, and I mean, all different types, from the old school R&B, hip hop, rap, I was living it. Culturally, I was a part of it. So it's great. I mean, it's definitely to be able to understand. I was living a fictitious life. Mm. I was actually living what I was listening to.
So you kind of married, you found a way to put together your life and what you understood and lived with maybe a business aspect of it?
Yeah. And I think, yeah, because one of my main things was, I have an old saying, kill the middleman. The middleman kills deals.
Amen.
So I always try to figure out to respectfully work with everybody, but at the same time, to have a guy, because I never was into the guy who, cashed the check. I was always to the guy who wrote the check.
Well, I can relate that to my industry because, you know, when I sell what I sell, the decision maker is, at the end of the day, the CEO of the company. Well, if I'm talking to a VP here and a VP there, it's, I learned very early on, I can talk to you and that's great, but you can't make a decision.
True statement.
Yeah, I got to get to the person who can make a decision. Otherwise, I'm wasting everybody's time, including mine.
Right. And that's the one thing about being an entrepreneur. I think the hardest part about being an entrepreneur, you have to understand you work for yourself. You kill what you eat.
Somebody asked me the definition of an entrepreneur. And I said, I don't know if it's a textbook definition or not, but my definition of an entrepreneur is you rely on you, yourself, or a very small team that you help put together for your income. You don't sell a product or service to a customer. You don't generate revenue. You don't eat.
True statement.
And that's hard.
I think a lot of times from a vision standpoint, we want everybody to buy into our vision. I don't think people buy into vision. I think people buy into results.
Interesting.
So, you know, you can have a vision. You can put up all the whiteboard.
You know,
but at the end of the day, one of my old guys told me, he was one of the smartest guys I ever met, named Al Misaka. He actually created some of the biggest tours in the world. And Al told me one day, he says, AP, he said, if you want to be successful in this business, he said, you have to believe in yourself. And even when it doesn't work, you got to figure out how to revamp and make it work, because you don't want that on your record. And he said, remember this. He said, you had a hit record yesterday. Yesterday doesn't count in this business.
Mm-hmm.
What do you have today?
Results.
Yeah, today. He said, you need a record today. Don't count on yesterday.
But there's something to a few people believing in your vision day one. You need some of those people to help you out. But at the end of the day, most people won't, but they're going to see your results, as you just mentioned,
well,
I think.
I think my mom and my sister played a big role in that. And my mom used to always tell me, because I would get frustrated, and she was like, anything worth having is worth working for. You're not going to get rich overnight on something you just figured out. I mean, you're new to it. You may be true to it, but you're new to it.
Hmm.
So she said, just take your time, and if it's meant for you, it'll happen. And I remember, I'll never forget, one time I was doing a deal and a guy offered me a brand new Mercedes. And she was like, is it brand new or is it pre-owned? I said, it was pre-owned. So she said, he's giving you something he doesn't want anymore. She said, so why don't you take the money instead?
Interesting.
She said, what are you going to do with a new Mercedes? She said, you need the money. She said, last I checked, you stand upstairs. So it made a lot of sense to me. So, you know, my mom, let her rest in peace. She was actually, she played a big role in my success. Her and my grandparents, you know,
awesome,
really being hard on me, because I veered off a lot of times. I grew up in a different era where, you know, the streets was calling, and, you know, either, you know, you was gonna eat or get ate with the neighborhood I grew up in.
That's rough. That's rough. There's been two guests on season two that live in beautiful Arizona. You're one of them. You now call it home. You're not from here, obviously, as we've heard in your past here. What are you doing now in Arizona? Because you're up to some big things. You've been for the past 20 years, but what are you doing now in Arizona?
So I'm partners in a company called Vitania, which is a brain performance company to actually help veterans with PTSD, but also law enforcement. And I do that as an individual through my company, APN Associates. Hmm. It's a consulting firm for emerging brands, emerging companies to help them get to the finish line. Wow. But then also, I actually buy small companies, participate as an investor in small companies and help them build them up. And I use my relationships and collaborations to grow them overnight and try to, you know, figure out ways to kind of reach across to some of the people that I've known on the come up from the bank capitals and some of the biggest equity groups in the world that I have relationships with to tell them I made a found a diamond in the rough.
Wow.
So that's one of the things I do. And then I have the Heroes on the Foundation. It's built up on three principles: entrepreneurship, education, employment, and then also community services. Not one of our pillars, but it's just something that we should be doing. And with the Heroes on the Foundation, I had a vision when the COVID broke out, and we did the largest COVID testing site in the United States of America in South Phoenix. Wow. I actually saw it break out and went and cut a deal with South Mountain Community College to use their facility. And we serviced the whole community and made national news, CNN, Good Morning America, everything. They're doing the largest COVID testing site in the United States. We've actually done some of the largest collaboration for veterans. We've worked with, we actually helped, because we were a firm believer that when veterans get out of the military, that they shouldn't just be a security guard. So we've worked with some of the places like SkillBridge on using veterans MOSs, Military Occupation Service, and showing how that translates to the civilian world. We work with Cyber Vets USA, which is a taking veterans and showing them how to get into cybersecurity. We have helped launch that with Cisco and with Admiral Pittman and his group. We've been doing our part. As we say, doing the Lord's work. We do the largest backpack drive. This year we did a drive-through where we serviced over 50,000 inner city kids over the last seven years. So some of the things we've done, I mean, I could go on and on and on, but we're just trying to do our part.
Two things just struck me when you were talking, and it's where I hope to be in a couple of years when I'm your age. I think you're about a year or two older than me. You give back. You found an effective way of being a community leader and giving back on that front. And then on the business front, I'm seeing this theme in your life of you have found the way to connect the dots with people and make an honest, ethical business out of it and generate revenue.
Right. I think that's
two strong pillars there in your life.
I think actually doing the right thing, people pay attention when you have no malice in your heart. You're sincere. You're trustworthy. The military taught me to adapt and overcome, and I've been able to do that. So I think in being able to do things genuinely has attracted people to me to want to work with me and support what I do. Because if I say I'm going to do something, I'm going to do it. And that's one of the things the military always taught me is to get to the finish line. Sports taught me that too. You know, it's not finished till you touch the line, till you get to the finish line. So I've actually used those principles to try to be successful in business.
Did you have the knowledge 10 years ago to do what you're doing now?
I say this. I always tell people, knowledge is great, but opportunity is greater. Because if you have the opportunity, eventually you'll get the knowledge if it's something you really care about.
If you keep going and practicing.
If you keep going and going. But opportunity is the most important thing. But sometimes we want an opportunity given to us. We have to create opportunity sometimes. So sometimes it's not about a handout. It's a hand up. Being able to reach back and pull somebody up and look them in the eyes and tell them they're capable of what they think they're not capable of and making them feel like a better person and making them excel because you only measure what you do for other people, not what you do for yourself. People never talk about people, what they've done for themselves. I mean, they always talk about what you've done for other people if you want your brand and your name to last.
Interesting. What you do for other people, that's so true. So true. What advice would you give veterans out there, specifically in the business and entrepreneurial community?
I think one of the things, we actually created a thing called the Heropreneur Academy to actually help veterans when they exit the military, to actually who want to start their own business. I think one of the things that I would say now, especially with COVID and the way the world is, the world will never be the same. So if you have an opportunity to work for yourself and you have the desire to work for yourself, figure out all the intricate pieces to become successful. Make sure you surround yourself with people who think like you, but people who will tell you the truth. Because if you got a lot of yes men around you, the answer is always going to be yes, but the result may be no.
Mm-hmm. So true. This is a reoccurring theme. We keep hearing it, and we keep hearing it from successful people. So veterans, please listen. This is why we're doing this show. Surround yourself with successful people. There are resources out there. Learn your craft. Keep going. Find the opportunity. Create the opportunity. AP, man, thank you so much for coming out.
Thank you.
Appreciate it.
Thanks.